Good afternoon. I'm Ellie, and I am an alcoholic. My, what a really turned out a group here, huh? Are there any newcomers? All old heads? I love it. Gee. What happened? Wow. Okay, here I go. Needless to say, I'm nervous as a cat. I put a few drinks in me, and boy, I was the loudest thing on the block. I could talk nonstop. He just tell me shut up. Now, I'm up here now, and I really don't know what to say, except that I'm grateful to be here. What it was like. You know, I was driving up from Tucson with my sister. She's in the audience out there. And I was reflecting back when I was just a kid. And I was really feeling good because today I'm sober. And I really didn't realize how sick I was then, even as a kid, okay? I was talking to my sister about feelings of loneliness, of anger, of fear, of so much fear, and I didn't know why. I really didn't understand why. I was scared from, the day I was born up until 1973. We came from a drinking family, okay? Dad drank quite a bit, and Mom sort of at that time. But we always had alcohol in the home. And we never thought too much about it because Dad would say, give me some of my medicine, you know, this type of thing. And it was okay. It was just part of our family life. And that's what we grew up in. I was a rebel from day one. I just couldn't do anything right. I questioned authority. I still do. I always felt like the fifth wheel on the wagon. I always felt like I never belonged. I really didn't know what was wrong with me. And at 12 years old, I remember it was Christmas time. We were in San Carlos, Arizona then, among the Apaches. And Dad and I had gotten into a really heavy, knockdown verbal battle again. And I was like 12 years old, and he had asked me to go do something, and I wanted to know why. I knew I wasn't going to do it. I just wouldn't. And so we really had a big one. And of course, he celebrated Christmas and he went to bed. And he always kept in the refrigerator a pint or a fifth of Seagram's 7. And he always had Coke, so we'd make him his Coke highs, you know. So I decided I was going to try a Coke high. I tried a Coke high. God, I loved it. Hey. I mean, it just started feeling nice and warm. I felt good. All of a sudden, I was real brave. Everything didn't appear to be as bad as it was. My sister had gotten some jacks for Christmas, and I was trying to play jacks with them. And I was seeing 3 and 4 and 10 jacks, and I was having a ball all by myself. And I kept drinking that. I couldn't stop. I loved it. I woke up on the bathroom floor in my puke the next morning. That was my first drunk. I was sick. I couldn't understand why they could drink the stuff. But I kept remembering how good I felt. I liked that high. And I was having to go to school in Globe Junior High at the time, and I didn't like going over there. I didn't like riding the bus. I didn't like anything. I couldn't wait to get home to sneak into the refrigerator and get a drink. Because then everything was then okay. Then I could speak and I could laugh and I could just feel like I belonged with the rest of the people, because most of the time I didn't feel like I belonged anywhere. That continued. And of course, Mother, he'd come home and find his whiskey down and or something. They'd have to go in the Globe to get more. And he kept bawling her out, thinking she was drinking it. But that was okay, you know. She could handle. She could handle. But it didn't stop there. We moved back to Sacaton. And again, I was at the age then, like 13 and 14, where the thing to do was go to all these dances out there, especially at July 4th, where they had chicken scratches and stuff, you know, and everybody drank. I mean, they had cars parked around at night, and it was all exciting, and you'd see fights all over behind the cars. Don't ask what we were doing behind the cars. Anyway, we danced, but we would drink. We would drink. And it got to be a game with a pint of wine where, let's see who could drink it the fastest. I could always drink it the fastest. I could down it in two. Just boom, boom. And I was wondering why I could always walk around while everybody else is drunk, getting sick, doing something. I was always the one still walking around, trying to dance, having a good time. I just didn't seem to have any end to my, what, drinking then. I could hold the booze. But I didn't think there was anything wrong with that. I thought it was terrific myself. But I always liked the feeling, because, see, I never drank for taste. I drank for effect. I drank so I could feel good, just good. Then I could function. Then I could look people dead in the eye and be able to talk and laugh and have a good time. But this kept on. I remember when we had a geographical cure, and I call it a geographical cure because now when we look back in retrospect, we realize now that Dad did have a drinking problem. And so we were constantly moving. We wound up moving to Bisbee, Arizona, and the uprooting again. I never could adjust to any situation well. Changes in environment, it took me a long time to adjust. So we got to Bisbee, and again, I didn't want to go to school. I was still acting out. I got to drinking, again, heavy. Since I wouldn't go to school, he said, well, you're going to have to go to work, which I thought was a neat thing because I wanted to be around with the grown-ups anyway, because that's where the drinking was. So I went to work in this restaurant, and I stayed there for a year and a half, working from dishwasher to cook. Whoopee. But I could drink. They had all the beer in the back. And on my little breaks, I'd sort of sneak through the side there and whip off. I didn't care if it was hot, as long as I had a drink. Then I got in good with one of the cooks. He was an alcoholic. He worked out at Fort Huachuca, and he always had kept a fifth of vodka stuck in behind our ice block in the walk-in cooler. So, yeah, we'd mix up, I mean, I was always out of it, you know. And I enjoyed that. Boy, I enjoyed that. I thought that was so neat. It was just running away all the time. It was just running away. Then we went to South Dakota. He and I got into another great big one again. And he asked me to leave home, and that was cool. So at 17 or 18, my aunt came down from South Dakota, and she said, you want to come back? And I said, yeah, I'll go. So I went back to South Dakota. Well, aunt was full-blown alcoholic. And we had a blast up there. I mean, I did nothing but drink up there with her. I did insane things. But see, there was a point, there came a point in my life then when I started having blackouts. And I didn't know what blackouts were, but they were frightening. I remember I got with a bunch of girls, three of them, and my grandmother had sent us into Gettysburg. This is a town about 25, 30 miles away to go get groceries. So we did. We went. We got the groceries, and we decided to stop in this place called Bud's Bar for one drink. One drink lasted all day. When I finally come out of this whole mess, we were in Lusk, Wyoming, in this sleazy motel room. Nothing but beer cans around us, whiskey bottles and stuff. And I asked them, what are we doing here? And they said, well, you brought us here. I said, I brought us here? I get lost driving around the block, let alone going to Lusk, Wyoming. But there we were. And we had my aunt's car. And it was a week later. We had eaten all the groceries. There we were. And that was my first really big experience with a blackout. I thought I was going crazy, and I got scared. I didn't know what to do. So we went back. We took turns driving, got back. And I told my aunt what had happened, and I told her I don't remember, and she didn't believe me. You know, she didn't understand about blackouts either. But that was cool. But I was going, getting crazier and crazier and crazier. I was doing things that I wouldn't normally do anywhere. I'd get into fist fights, you know, with people. I used to like to go out to Fort Pier. They had a bar in there where we shot pool. And that was great because we'd shoot for drinks. You know, that's fine. You had pitchers of beer or glasses of beer, depending on what it was. And I got to guards pretty good because why? I would win beer. So I used to have these little pitchers of beer all lined up on the bar, you know, and I'd let them sit there. And then I'd get all through shooting pool, and generally I would find a partner, and it didn't matter to me if it was somebody else's husband. It just didn't matter. As long as he could shoot pool so we could have some beer. That was the name of the game. So needless to say, I had many wives on my tail. They were very upset. I learned how to sit with my back against the door, because usually these wives would come up with their purse and whack me upside the head or something, you know. So yeah, I used to sit facing the door all the time. And then there was a guy called Casey Tibbs. He was the youngest bronc rider, I believe, in the state of South Dakota. And in Fort Pier, they had a big celebration for the guy. And so that's when they have, rodeos and just everything going on. And we went up there and we borrowed some horses and we were just really doing rodeo up there, me and my friends. Well, I got into this Fort Pier bar and I started another fight and they 86'd me. And so I blew my cork. I got mad. And I took my horse and I rode that some pup right in there and I tore up the joint. And that's one of the crazy things I did. I thought it was normal. We went out to Mobridge, too, to Timber Lake, to all over. They knew me. They knew me. Zella, if you're going to come and visit us, don't bring her. Don't bring Eleanor. Don't bring her. Leave her home. Lose her somewhere, you know. Yeah, I like to party, you know. But the only thing was, I couldn't stop. I could not stop drinking once I started. And I would be drinking long after everybody was passed out. I'd be the one driving a car. I just couldn't quit. I just could not quit. Excuse me. And then my mother wrote me a letter saying, will you come down and help the family? This was in June of 58, something like that. Oh, incidentally, I did go to school, but it interfered with my drinking, too. And I came back to Sacaton again, and then the sift really hit the fan. I don't know. It was just downhill from God. I just could not quit. It when I think back now, I just wonder about the obsession, the addiction. And no one really wanted to talk about it. But on the reservation, you don't really think about too much about that because everybody does it. Everybody does it. You know, or almost everybody. I don't know. I know that my mother was at a loss. She told me I was drinking too much. The girls started drinking then, too. I was grossly unhappy. I didn't know what to do. I didn't know where to go. You can't find jobs on a res. It was depressing for me. And then finally we hit on, well, why don't we go to California? So we moved to Oakland, California. We relocated over there. And I thought, good, well, it's going to get better. It will get better. It didn't. It got worse. My drinking got worse. I finally found a job. And if any of you have ever gone under relocation, under the Bureau of Indian Affairs, oh, my God, you know. They get you over there and they forget you, right? So there we were, and I finally managed to get a job out in Berkeley, California, over in an insurance company. What did I know about insurance? But it was a job. But I drank myself out of that one. we finally wound up having to come home. Dad couldn't find work. I couldn't stay sober. Mother couldn't work. Girls were too young. So we came back to where? Sacaton. So it started all over again. And there we stayed. I finally got out of that mess and went to Phoenix College. Talked to a guy by the name of Hardin, conned him into having the Bureau of Indian Affairs pay for my education, right? So I went to Phoenix College, and I did well for 1 year. 1 year. And then I started drinking again. And, hey, it's kind of awful sitting in a classroom, and you start hearing bells, and you jump up, and nobody else does. You know, it got to where, hey, No. I wanted to drink. I wanted to forget school. It interfered again. School just flat interfered. So I just let it go, forget school. I found a job at a little old hamburger joint there on 7th Street in Roosevelt called Bill's Ranch House or some damn thing. And there I worked. But see, I could drink on the job there, too. I had my six-pack of beer stuck out in the back, and it wasn't no little old shorties. It was them great big tallies. I love them things. And it got to where I'd bring one. Then it was two. Pretty soon it was a six-pack. Finally, I just stashed a case in the trash can back there. That was my stash. And I would just stay drunk all the time, just always lit, just enough. I was afraid to come down because one time I tried it, I said, well, I'm not going to drink today. Cool. And you know, I started hearing things. I started seeing things. It was weird. And I found that if I go ahead and drink a couple of them, that these noises would quit. I could function. I didn't have a shake so bad. That everything, but I had to maintain then that level all the time. And that was frightening. I knew then that I was hooked, but I would not ask for help. Hell, I got myself in this mess. I'll get myself out of it, you know. I'm not hurting anybody but myself. But, you know, as we go on this thing, that's not true. That really isn't true. I was hurting everybody who even cared about me. My family was scared to death of me. I finally wound up drinking myself out of jobs and went back to Sacaton. And there were my folks. And when I finally did go home, though, it was because my dad was then dying, okay, of acute alcoholism. While he was in intensive care, and I came home, and we were there. And yeah, it's not a pretty sight. But that did not change me either. The only thing that changed me there, well, I saw all these tubes and things running from my father and stuff. I asked God to help him. Please help him. Make him well. Well, it didn't happen. He died. And I left that room. I was angry. I turned my back on God. There is no God. I felt sorry for myself. I said, look, I have never asked you for anything. This time I asked you for something and you wouldn't give it to me. Then leave me. Go. Leave me alone. And I did. I did downhill drinking then until 1972. I stayed in Sacramento for that while, though. And I worked for a program called, what is it? Anyway, I worked with a guy by the name of Delbert A. He's gone now. A lady by the name of Esther French. And we had our program underneath the hospital in the basement, right next to the morgue. And I worked in there as their secretary. I had a good time in there because all these drunks, all these Indian guys come in there, or women, wanting to talk to a counselor. I thought that was terrific. And I'd listen to their problems, and I could relate. I wonder why, you know. And I'll say, yeah, why not? Why don't we just go get a drink and talk about that? So we'd go in Castrani, get a bottle, and we'd all be drunk, right? So I start taking my booze to work. I would file my wine under W. You know, I had beer in the back behind the file cabinet. I had my stash in there. I even had it behind that little door that goes into the morgue, right? I had my stash. And there I am, supposed to be representing our alcoholism program out there. I could not stay sober. I finally went down with DTs. And my sister was there when I went out. I slipped completely out. I mean, that was horrendous. I don't know if anybody's ever had DTs, but I don't recommend it. It's... Whoa. I'll sing Spiders. Every time I hear that song, Spiders and Snakes, by what his name, I got start getting the willies, you know. Oh, I tell ye, I wound up over at the hospital, and they were trying to figure out what was wrong with me. They said, do you drink? And I said, no, a little bit, but I do smoke too much. So they said, quit smoking and you're going to be okay, you know. So I quit smoking for a week, but needless to say, I wasn't drinking either, so I got okay. So I thought smoking was the problem. So that was fine. So then they decided, well, there's a gal by the name of Mrs. Cimino, who was the RN out there at the hospital. And she said, Ellie, you've got the brains and you've got the smarts and you're so talented. And I said, oh, sing it. I know it, you know. And she said, would you like to come up here and work part-time as our ward clerk? I said, what's a ward clerk? And she says, well, you're the gal where all these doctors come and they give you these CBC thingies and you note them on the patient's charts and you pull all these things for the patients and give them to the doctors. I said, well, now that sounds simple enough. Well, no one told me I had to stay sober to do that, see. So there I am up there in the ward, you know, and the doctor gives me... You ever seen doctor's writing? I mean, you can't read it sober, let alone drunk. I mean, so there I am. I don't know who got a CBC and who got a PD, who and whatever, but I was just attaching him to all kinds of patients. God, maybe they give you guys the wrong blood. I don't know. But in any case, I was working and I was having a good time up there until I started drinking again. And she talked to me and she begged me and she says, Ellie, you've got to put the bottle down. I said, I would like to put the bottle down, but I can't. I can't. She says, well, we have an alcoholism problem. I said, I know. I was down there with them. That's where I got fired from, huh? But no. So it would not work. So once again, I had to go down the route with the DTs again. And poor sister again had to put up with me running across the desert and sending... I mean, these things were... So I wound up back in the hospital again. They were giving me shots to knock me out. I would not go out. I survived that again, okay? Then I decided, well, I'll go to Apache Junction. They needed a live-in housekeeper. I mean, I'm just going boom, 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 boom. They needed a live-in housekeeper in a place in Apache Junction. And I thought, well, good. It's way out there in the boonies. The stores are a long way off. These are going to be white people. White people don't drink, do they? Well, we got over to Apache Junction. Come to find out, the husband is a practicing alcoholic. And so much for staying away from the booze, because then they built a Circle K about 150 yards from the house. So Miss Ellie was trotting down there getting her booze again, and I could not. I stayed there almost a year and a half. And I liked it out there. It was nice. People were friendly. Again, I couldn't. I had four children to watch. I don't know how we did it, but we did it. And then I went home for Thanksgiving, back to Sacatone again. Went home for Thanksgiving, and I started drinking. Hellfire, I was still giving thanks at Christmas time, you know. I didn't go back. And finally I thought, well, New Year's, this is it. This is it. I've had it. I'm not going to drink no more. That's all. This is it. No more. So I got back to Apache Junction, and I'm all set to go. This is Miss Sobriety now. No more booze. There was beer in the refrigerator. Wouldn't touch it. I didn't know that if you drank continuously for so long without a break, that when you all of a sudden quit, that bam, it hit me all of a sudden. I was sitting at the table playing cards. Everybody was going to go out to have a New Year's party and everything. And there was this voice right there at the window outside somewhere that said, Eleanor. Oh, no. And I knew. I started going wild. I was trying to be calm. And I began tightening up. I know now, when I think back, that I was starting alcoholic convulsions. I knew that. I would not drink. I spent 2 days fighting the DTs. The family knew something was wrong, but I would not say anything except that I would hear these voices. I would see these things. And I had 4 kids to watch. I could not lose it. I think the worst fear I had out of all my drinking, I wasn't afraid of dying. I was afraid I might live. Good Lord, you know. I was afraid to lose my mind. There ain't much there now, but I was afraid to lose it. So for 2 days I fought it. Finally, I went to Joe and I told him, he's the lady's husband, and said, I've got to go back to Sacketone. I've got to go. He said, what's the matter? I said, Joe, I drank too much and I think I'm having what they call DTs. And he said, oh, shit, you know. So he loads me in the car. And away I come, and I get out to Sacketone about 2 in the morning, and Arlene, my sister, is there again. And there she is. I came home, but I knew then I wasn't going to drink. I couldn't drink. I knew that if I went to the refrigerator there at Thatcher Junction, I could come out of it. But by then I had enough, I thought. And there was a half a pint of wine sitting on the table at the house in Sacketone when I got there. I knew if I drank that, I would be again okay. But then it would start the ball rolling again. I knew that. So I went absolutely bananas. Sharon, my sister who used to work in social service, came to my rescue there. I was totally out of it by then. I'm just a wreck, a mental wreck. I'm rambling, I'm talking, I don't really know much what I said or did. All I know is that she came, loaded me into a van, and whipped me all over Sacketone for whatever reason. I'm riding around in this van. And then somehow they snuck me over to the hospital. They were going to stop for something, they said, and I thought that was good. But they got me out of the van, took me into the hospital itself. And my God, they descended on me like locusts. I mean, there was people all over, the nurses, and they had, syringes, and they were going to shoot me up, which they did. And I told them, don't give me any more shots, because I was at the place in my head then that I knew if I went to sleep, I would die. I knew that. Everything was just there. Now, I don't know if anybody's ever got to that place but I was there. And they kept bringing that needle in there. I said, don't give me, just let me work up from wherever I'm at right now, because if I go to sleep, doctor, I'll die. Now, just don't do that. I have no fight left, none. Just leave me alone. Well, my friend Esther French came to the rescue. She said, I will sit with her. And she did. For 4 days, I was out of it. But they didn't give me any more shots. And she stayed there. I would see these things. Oh my God, it was ugly. But she stayed. If I know any of my sobriety today, it's partly to Esther, who was so patient and who did stay. There's a guy by the name of Leonard. I think you all know him. I'll break his anonymity and say Leonard Pancott. Big, tall Indian dude. Ball-headed one. First one I ever saw. But my buddy, he made arrangements for me to go to the Sacketone halfway house. I didn't know what I was doing. I didn't even know where I was going. I didn't care. I was almost a vegetable by that point. So I finally go up to the halfway house, and a guy by the name of Luther M. was the halfway house manager then. Leonard was the assistant. I went into that house, and all I did was sleep for 2 weeks. That's all I did. The doctors, well-meaning, gave me some Librium to calm me down, they said. And if it hadn't been for Leonard, I would have got hooked also on Librium. Because I found out that every I look at my watch, and every time it was 10 o'clock, every time it was 2, 6, and 10, I was there at the door waiting for my pill. I wanted my pill, you know. And I had a fit if they did not give me my pill. So he grabbed me and went in there and grabbed my Librium out of the desk, went to the toilet, and flushed him down. He said, "Now you're going to shake it off." Do you know that was worse than alcohol? I'm telling you. It was worse. I went through all kinds, just around little old Librium, 25 milligrams. To this day, I cannot take pills. I won't take pills unless I just have to. But Leonard wasn't nice at all. He was one of these hard dose AA people. He didn't baby you. He gave me heck all the time. He kicked me in the butt, and that's what I needed. I could con these people. I could get around these people who were nice to me, you know, because then I could get away and sneak and have a drink and do all kinds of things. But not with him. It was too hard. I just didn't want it. I'll stay sober now. I'm all dried out, and I'll do it my way. But I would see that people would get to meetings, and, oh, I would do all these things. I'd find every excuse not to go with the bunch to a meeting. I would do this. And then in October of 1972, there at the halfway house, I was going to Chandler on business for the house, and I don't know what possessed me. I decided to go to Gilbert, and I picked up a pint of vodka and a six-pack of 7-Up, and I started drinking in the staff wagon. I don't know where I wound up. I don't know where I went, what I did, even how I got back to the house, but I was there the next morning. That was my drunk. I told him about it, and I think by at that point in time, I think I had enough sobriety in me to realize I had done something wrong. I had violated their trust. I had done all these things. And I called a meeting, and I told the bunch, "Hey, this is what's happening." I didn't want to be there anymore. I was so ashamed. I couldn't look him in the eye. I couldn't do many things. I just felt so bad. I felt a loss. Maybe I didn't have good sobriety, but it was sobriety nevertheless. Or let's say I was dry, okay? I couldn't stay there, so then Leonard called Hope Manor in Phoenix. Oh, God, talk about out of the frying pan into the fire, because in Hope Manor they taught nothing but religion next. It was hard enough trying to get the spiritual program, and then they go off into the religion. And I could not handle that. And then they put me on antabuse, right? Have any of you drank on antabuse? I don't try that either. I got over to Hope Manor, and there I am in this house with all these old biddies who are all sitting in the corner, feeling so sorry for themselves, won't do anything, and I'm full of life and energy, I'm ready to go to work, and I'm doing this, and I'm doing that, and they say, "God, she must be on something for her to have that much energy." Well, these people in the halfway house there at Hope Manor weren't up on alcoholism. They felt that if you got the Lord, then everything was going to be copacetic, you could just put the booze down, everything would be okay. It didn't work that way. I remember this house mother came up to me by the name of Grace, and she says, "Are you drinking?" I said, "Well, no, I'm not drinking." I said, "My God, if I was drinking, I wouldn't be here. I wouldn't be here." I said, "No, I'm not drinking." And she said, "Well, what is it with all this energy?" And I said, "God, I'm happy to be alive. Is there something wrong with that?" And she said, "No, you have got to be drinking." I said, "I'm taking antabuse." I said, "I'm taking antabuse so I won't drink." And she says, no, I don't believe you." I said, "Then I'll drink on antabuse and I will show you." But I didn't do it at the time. I said, "No, Grace, you've got to read." So I got some information from Good Sam. I took it back to her and I said, "I want you to read this. Please read this." She did. She did not understand it. So once again, I went running up the stairs and running down the following Sunday, and she says, she grabs me by the arm and she says, "You've got to be drinking. Let me smell your breath, you know." Let me smell your breath. Oh, you've done. Anyway, I got so mad, I bounced out of that house. I walked over to the corner on 7th and Roosevelt. I picked me up a pint of Donsky Don, straight down half the bottle before I got half back to the house on the Anabuse. Now, can you imagine what was going on? I thought I was going to die before I even got there. I got up to my room. I had sense of mind to keep my pint in my purse. And I laid down, and I thought I was going to die. All I could hear was my blood rushing, freight train, sweat. I got beet red. My eyes were horrible. I looked like something out of Friday the 13th or something. And I stayed like that for about 4 hours. I couldn't stand it anymore, and I got up and I left. I said, I have to leave. And I went out the back door. I finished off the pint. Then I went over to downtown, got the bus, went out to up my friend's place on Southern. At that point, she had gone to Chicago to a workshop. I went in her house. I got her car keys. She had a beautiful Grand Prix. I got in her car. I got me another pint of vodka. I'm still a wreck. And I guess because I was in such a state, I wanted to see my mother. So I got in her car. I took off, and I'm still drinking. And somewhere on Baseline, I had a blackout, and I could see me hurtling towards this car. I came out of it, and all I could see was the back end of this car coming. And I hit the brakes. I managed to get out of that one. I hung a right going into Chandler, and I don't know what happened. All I know is that when I fell out of the car, I had hit a trailer rig. I had bounced off it into a telephone pole, they said, going like about 85 miles an hour. The battery was sitting right here. I did not get a scratch, not one little scratch. I got out of the car, and the first thing I could think about was hiding the evidence. So I got my pint, this much in it. I finished it off real fast, and I managed to stumble across to what is now Stapley's. I guess Stapley's out there somewhere. And I threw it into the trash can, came back. And then the police came, and they wondered how much I had to drink, a couple beers. They took me in, handcuffed me. They took me into Chandler, and I graced the new Chandler jail. The new Chandler jail. And they did the drunk thing on me, what you call it, and then you blow into something. And that son of a pup, I mean, it just went, that was it. And they said I should have been in a coma. I was not. I called my friend Leonard. I asked him, please come. You know, that son of a pup left me in there all night long in the drunk tank with this other drunk lady who was always puking and mad and drunk and carrying on, and I'm in there with her, me, the graduate of Budweiser's University. I'm in there with her. No. But you know what happened? The minute they shut that door, I was telling my sister that was a turning point in my life. The minute they shut that jail door, that's when I bottomed out, because then I knew. I had no control over my life, that people had the keys to my life, literally, that I was at their mercy. I could not go. I couldn't do anything except sit in that jail. That was it. I'm sorry. That was it. No more. I knew then if I kept drinking that this was what it was going to be then, starting the jails. I found God there in that jail, in the drunk tank, right there in Chandler, Arizona. I did. I was so frightened. I was so scared. I was sick. I didn't know what to do. I was at a loss. I did. I finally said, God, help me. Help. Please help me. No bargaining. No nothing. Just that. He did. So who comes charging in there early in the morning with a hat under his arm but Leonard Pancock? Here he comes. Gets me out of jail. I have to pay back the $250 fine. Yeah. I went from Hope Manor then over to a place called the Turning Point where it really started then. I was ready to program. I was ready to program. I haven't stopped since. God has been good in my life, like I said. It's just one of those things. You know, when my dad died, like I said, he and I had such a love-hate relationship. And even when he was dying, I could not say, I'm sorry, or Dad, forgive me, or Dad, I love you. I couldn't and would not do it, the pride. And he left. And I realized that that was part of my problem. But again, my mother, who had a terminal illness called scleroderma, came to stay with me for 2 years of my sobriety, right? I was 2 years sober. And she came to stay with me. I was able to make amends to my dad. I was able to do many things through my mother. I learned a lot from my mother. I didn't even realize she was a person. You know, you just assume mama is mama, right? She's just mama. Mama will always be there. Well, mom was there for me when I needed her the most. She was there. My mother finally went to the hospital. She said, take me to the hospital. I'm hurting. Because mother would not go. She was rugged. I did not know on October 19th that this was going to happen. It was Friday. And my sponsor asked me, she and her husband Chuck, asked me if I would take them out to show them how to get out to Sacatone, to the halfway house, because they were both going to speak there at the meeting that night. And I said, well, my mom's in a hospital. I really don't think I need to go. I should be up there with her. And they said, well, she's going to be okay. I had just seen her the previous day. So I said, okay, I'll take you out there. So I came back, took them out there, went to the meeting. I heard beautiful things in that meeting that night. I'm telling you, if I had not gone to that meeting, I don't know. I got back, and the phone rang at 10 o'clock that night, and they told me Mama had passed. I didn't know what to do at the moment. I called my family. I called the police to get a hold of my people, tell them that this had come down. I will say that through adversity, through all the things that have gone down in my life, that this program has done it for me. I then learned then to just picked up the book. I began calling people. I began working this program. I began saying, hey, this too shall pass. This too shall pass. All these things are put in our lives now. We think that just because we sober up, it's going to be a bed of roses. It isn't. He never promised us that. He doesn't promise that. Doesn't. Hey, what you do about the program is up to you. I got so sick of hearing people say, well, I tried AA and it didn't work for me. And I said, well, did you work the program? Did you work the program? Well, I didn't make it in AA. I got drunk and blah, blah. And I said, well, what step were you working? This program has saved my life. This program is why I'm functional today. This program, hopefully, is why my family and I are closer. I can deal with people today where before I could not. I know that when we stand around and we say, oh God, why me? Why do I have all these problems? Why do we have all these things happening to me? I used to say, why me, Lord? Why me? And my sponsor would say, well, why not you? You know. Now, today I can look at them as challenges as opposed to problems, as opposed to anything. They are challenges to me. It's another road to conquer, another hurdle to go over. Because why? Because we get stronger. We get stronger as we go, day after day after day. But we got to do it one day at a time. That was the key. One day at a time. And I learned how to do that. And it was hard. I had to stay sober 1 minute at a time. Today, by the grace of God, April 1st is my sobriety date, 1973. I have not found it necessary to take a drink. I have not found it necessary to take a drink because I'm still doing it one day at a time. My friend Leonard says, He has a good analogy. He says, if you're reaching up to help somebody and you're reaching down, you haven't got one free hand to pick up the drink. And that's true. That is true. My life is going along splendidly. I have, like you say, problems. But you know what? I'm not alone. We're all winners. We're survivors. All of us sitting in this room, we're all survivors. And we're all winners. We're here today. We're sober. God, you can't ask for much more than that today. Tomorrow we're not even worried about. Today is all we got. This is it. And I'm so glad to be here, and I'm happy to have shared with you. Thank you.